thank you for coming. I don't know how you can find your way through all the traffic stuff, but you must be the smart people. Before I start talking about the new book, I need to tell you that The Ballad of Frankie Silver, which was a New York Times bestseller back in the 90s, has been adapted into play form by the Parkway Playhouse. You know how to get there from here? Go to Asheville, God help you. Keep going up 26 like you're going to Tennessee, but there'll be a little sign off of 26 that says Burnsville Spruce Pine. Okay, Burnsville is a little town which has a nonprofit theater called the Parkway Playhouse. They have adapted Frankie Silver, and it opens on the 4th of June, so 2 weeks from tomorrow, and they have a 19-year-old girl who's local playing Frankie Silver, and she looks so much like the written descriptions of Frankie that it's frightening. Frankie Silver, if you don't know, was the first woman hanged for murder in the state of North Carolina. It was 1833. They're dramatizing this case. And the playhouse is only about a dozen miles from where it really happened. So on the day of the premiere, it premieres Saturday night, June 4th. That morning, I'm taking a group of people up to the graves and showing them where it happened. And the girl who's playing Frankie Silver is coming with us. So if that's not a photo op, I don't know what it is. So this is a tour that started a week ago back in Virginia. And next week, it's going to be quite challenging. See, New York publicists don't go very far from Manhattan. And they're used to, when you say state, they think Connecticut, Rhode Island. So this is what I'm doing next week. Tuesday, Virginia Commonwealth University luncheon in Richmond, Virginia. Wednesday, East Tennessee Historical Society, Knoxville. Thursday, Nashville. Friday, Memphis. Saturday, Jackson, Mississippi. And Sunday, Atlanta. And driving and talking. See, they can't get their head around the fact that Tennessee has two time zones. It's only that far on the map from Nashville to Memphis. So anyway, off I go, and after that comes the play and some more things in June, and I end up, the last signing is June 28th in Anchorage, Alaska. So if anybody understands stereotyping, it's going to be them. If I get any questions about hillbillies and moonshining and all the stereotypes, I'm going to say, before I answer that, would you take me out in the parking lot so I can pet your sled dogs before you go home from the igloo? Anyhow, this book, which came out last week, is based on a true story. People ask me, how much is true? Because so many of my books are only fiction in the sense that in, say, 1780, there were no tape recorders running. So if I want to put dialogue in my book, I have to guess at what people said. But when you guess at what they said or what color the horse was or whatever, then you are fictionalizing the story. But it isn't fictionalized very much. Did they say pass the salt, or please would you pass the salt if it's not too much trouble, or give me the salt? I don't know which one they said. I have to guess according to the personality of the speaker, but I do know the salt was passed. So to that extent, you can trust me. The Ballad of Frankie Silver, I spent 4 years researching that book because we know that when Charlie Silver was killed, Frankie's father and her older brother were on a long hunt in Kentucky. This is 1831. When you walk, it takes a while to get to Kentucky. They left before he died. They didn't come back until he had been dead for over a month. So they're so many hundreds of miles out of the picture. But they were there in 1833 in July when she was hanged. And her father was in the crowd. He had brought his wagon to take his daughter's body back home up to above Spruce Pine near Bakersville to bury her. And they asked her if she had any last words. According to the English common law that we were under in 1832 in North Carolina, defendants could not testify. So she was never allowed to tell her part of the story. She never talked to anybody about it. It's the first time she'd ever been to town. And so at the trial, that's my son, this is Spencer. If anybody follows me on Facebook, that's the evil genius. So she's got the rope around her neck. She's standing on the back of the wagon. The sheriff who's about to hang her, John Boone, the nephew of Daniel Boone, is crying because he has daughters her age, and he thought that the governor was going to come through and pardon her, and that didn't happen. Anyway, they asked Frankie if she had any last words. And you're supposed to have last words in 1833 because it was a very religious time, and they thought that if you repented, you would not save your life, but you would be forgiven and you could go to heaven. So many a highwayman repented on the gallows for fear of the hereafter. And here's Frankie, and she's 19 years old and about to die and leave a little 2-year-old baby behind. She steps forward and starts to speak, and her father's in the crowd, and he yells out, "Die with it in you, Frankie." In other words, shut up. And she stepped back and was hanged without saying a word. But Daddy didn't do it because he was in Kentucky. So what did he not want her to say? That's why I didn't make anything up, because I treated this like a math problem. If you change a number in a math problem, you change the answer. And I wanted the real answer to what did he not want her to say. So I spent 4 years interviewing descendants, attorneys, deputy sheriffs, people at Scotland Yard, FBI profilers, psychologists, psychics, everybody, and they all came up with the same answer. And I interviewed them individually, but we all came to the same conclusion. So I think I got it right. But that's why I don't change anything, because if I'm dealing with the facts, I want to know what happened. Tom Dooley, same thing. Got the trial transcript, read all this, studied the different people. I had 3 psychologists helping me with that book because we all figured out early on that the chief witness in the trial was a sociopath. You try writing a book in which the narrator is a sociopath. Sociopaths are not necessarily serial killers. I mean, don't think Criminal Minds. Think used car salesmen. So, it's just people who don't empathize with other people. So, they have basically 2 emotions, rage and gloating. No joy, no sympathy, no fear. So many emotions just aren't on their radar. So, I had to write a book in which the person telling the story really isn't feeling very much. And that's very different from what you're usually doing. So I would have to send chapters off to the psychologist, and they'd say, "No, no, she said she felt sorry for that little girl. Take it out." That won't happen. Anyway, so the Ballad of Frankie Silver was really groundbreaking, because back when the nonfiction books were written about him, there wasn't a lot of information available, like Civil War records. In the 1970s, you had to go through the filing cabinets to find Civil War records. If you can find, now they're all online. I got Tom Dula's war record in an hour from Michael Hardy, who's your Civil War historian here in North Carolina, and was able to bring information to that story that had never been available before. So I deal with facts as much as I can. Oh, and Kings Mountain. Kings Mountain is the ballad novel that came before this one. Thomas Jefferson called the Battle of Kings Mountain the turning point of the American Revolution, that we might have lost the war if that battle hadn't happened, and it's not in the history books. I know, I went to junior high school in North Carolina, and we had an American Revolution unit, and they talked about Valley Forge and Brandywine and Concord Bridge and Trenton and all that stuff with George Washington. You know, and you would have thought that everybody south of Pennsylvania had just gone to the beach for 4 years because there was nothing about what happened in the South. But here's Thomas Jefferson saying this battle, Kings Mountain, 26 miles west of Charlotte, was the turning point of the war. And the people who fought it were from around here. So I decided that these guys needed to go in the history books. And what happened was the British Army sent an officer named Patrick Ferguson down to South Carolina mainly to get rid of him because nobody wanted to work with him. And they said, okay, Patrick, you can't get in any trouble in South Carolina. So here's what we want you to do. Convince all the nice people who own plantations down there in South Carolina to stay loyal to the crown, okay? And persuade them that they really, really need the British Army to stay here and take care of them. So Patrick thinks, how can I persuade these people to want us? So he said, if you guys aren't careful, those barbarians up in the mountains are going to come down here and get you. He did not mean the Cherokee, he meant you. So then he really got carried away, and he wrote a letter to Isaac Shelby, who lived at Shelby's Fort, which is now called Bristol. And in the letter he said to Shelby, if you people don't stay out of the war, I'm going to come up there and burn your farms and kill your families. Well, they had stayed out of the war. They were busy up in Johnson City, that area, which was then western North Carolina all the way to the Mississippi. They were fighting the Cherokee. They were taming the land. They were living on the frontier in log cabins. And their attitude toward the war had been, good luck with that. Let me know who wins. But all of a sudden, this threatening letter comes from a British officer. And Shelby took the letter to John Sevier, who was living in Jonesboro. And he said, look, we got a personal invitation to the war. So they called their militias together and bought gunpowder from Mary Patton, who was the powder maker in Elizabethton, which also amused me. You know, when they're trying to get female students interested in the American Revolution, they trot out Betsy Ross because she made the first American flag. Well, Mary Patton, who was 29 years old and had just had a baby, made 500 pounds of gunpowder, and that is what they used in the battle. So off they went, and they're not regular army. They're not Continental Army. Nobody ever paid them. They were not given weapons or horses or uniforms or rations or anything. They were the neighborhood watch from over the mountain. Found the 73rd Regiment, dispatched them in an hour, sent word to the Continental Congress and said, we just beat the 73rd British Regiment. And Congress said, it can be done. You can do that, because Washington was losing at that point, which is why this was the turning point. They said, but you know, if the Brewerton Club of Western North Carolina can beat the British Army, then George Washington has a shot at it. The other thing that was, I thought, really important to remember about this is that it was a who's who of the American frontier. The following people were in that battle that isn't in the history books. The first governor of Kentucky, Isaac Shelby. The first governor of Tennessee, John Sevier. Patrick Henry, the governor of Virginia, his brother-in-law, William Campbell, was the head of the Virginia militia. He was there. Davy Crockett's father fought with Sevier's men. Robert E. Lee's father was there with the Virginia militia. And the grandfather of North Carolina's Civil War governor, Zebulon Vance. All those people were in that battle. So I thought at least, you know, people ought to know about it. As a speaker for the dead, I want all these people to be remembered. Didn't change anything. I mean, what else do you need? The gunpowder maker with the newborn baby, two governors. You know, it was just a collection of legends. So I didn't change anything. This book was more problematic for several reasons. It is based on a true story. So what is true? It's true that in 1935, a man who was in his early 40s ran for sheriff in a small town and won. He had a wife and he had young children. got the job of sheriff, was sworn in January of 1936, and in March of 1936, he got pneumonia. 1936 is about 6 years before you wanted to get pneumonia because there are no antibiotics. They can't do anything, even if you're young and strong. And he died within a week of pneumonia. And this, remember too, 1936 is the middle of the Depression. So the economy is not good. And suddenly here's this woman with small children who thought her husband was good for another 20 or 30 years. And suddenly she's got no income and kids to support that she stands in danger of losing. There's no safety net socially, no Social Security or anything that's going to help her from the government. The local government has no insurance on their county employees. They have no pension plan. They have no lump sum of money that they can give this poor woman. So they meet and think, what can we do for her to keep her from losing her house and her family? And somebody says, why don't we just let her take over her husband's job? You know, it's not the first time that's happened. There was a woman sheriff in the 1920s in Texas who did exactly that. She took over her husband's job, although only for 3 months. This woman's got a 3-year term, but that would give her a paycheck for 3 years. And they said, well, you know, we have deputies. We have big, strong male deputies. They can go out and issue the arrest warrants and arrest people and do all of the physical, hard labor part of law enforcement. And the little lady, who's nominally the sheriff, can sit in the office and answer the phone and write the reports and do all that paperwork, which is woman's work. What can go wrong? What happened was, she took office in March, and in May, a drifter in town raped and murdered an older woman, stole her jewelry, and was caught within 2 hours. He confessed, he had the jewelry on him, he had the victim's blood on him, and he was quickly sentenced to death. In those days, in that place, hanging was the method of execution, and it was public. It was also done personally by the sheriff of the county where the crime happened. Only this time, the sheriff is a housewife. That's why the title is called Prayers the Devil Answers. A prayer the devil answers is an old folk saying that means you wish for something and you get your wish, but in a terrible way that you did not foresee. The classic example of that is The Monkey's Paw, the short story in which the poor old couple wishes for $10,000. And a couple of days later, their son is killed in an accident at the factory where he works, and his insurance policy made out to them is for $10,000. So that's a prayer the devil answers. You get what you wanted, but you wouldn't have wanted it if you'd known how it was going to come true. So her prayer was to be able to have an income so that she could pay the rent and keep her kids. And the price of it is, can you kill a man? All that happened. And that's the plot in the book, but there's some differences. First of all, it did happen in 1936. It was the last public hanging in America. But it didn't happen in Tennessee, which is where I said it. It happened in Owensboro, Kentucky, which is way western Kentucky, and I don't do Kentucky. All of my books are set in the mountains somewhere. I don't know, you know, whether it's that they say hotcakes or pancakes in Kentucky. It's a slightly different culture. So I decided that I was going to have to change some things about this case in order to do the story. So I moved it. And I beg Tennessee's pardon for that, because Tennessee was not hanging people publicly in 1936. In fact, they were using the electric chair in Tennessee. The last public hanging in the state of Tennessee was in 1880 in Rutherford County in Murfreesboro. in case you're interested, because I am now the Martha Stewart of hangings after doing Tom Dooley and Frankie Silver. The last case in North Carolina was in the 1890s. It was the hanging of Peter DeGrafe, whom you will not have heard of unless you know a folk song that goes, "Poor Ellen Smith, how was she found? Shot through the heart, lying cold on the ground." That song is about that incident. He was hanged in Winston-Salem, up on the little hill where the YWCA now stands. The last hanging in Virginia, where I'm from, was 1897. But Kentucky was still going strong in 1936. And I think the reason that it was the last public hanging was for two reasons. Number one, because a woman was involved, and public sensibilities rebelled at that idea of her being out in front of 10,000 people doing this. The second thing, though, and maybe even more important, was if you were hanging somebody in 1880 or 1897, it's a fairly local event. There might be some little something written up and sent off, but there's no immediacy to it outside of where it actually happened. 1936, you've got Time Magazine, you've got Life Magazine, you've got reporters in Washington and Chicago and New York who can hop on a train and go to wherever the news is happening and report as eyewitnesses. You have radio stations whose reporters can take their equipment out into the field. When Floyd Collins was trapped in the sandstone cave in 1929 in Kentucky, radio reporters were wandering around in the field outside the cave, broadcasting. So you know they had radio reporters at that hanging, broadcasting what happened. They had photographers taking pictures of the hanging. And all this hit the national news so that everybody from coast to coast knew about it. I found stories about this incident in papers from New Orleans, from Greensboro, from New York, from Chicago. So everybody had this kind of in their face. And that's when people said, no, this is it. We're not doing this anymore. So that was the last time that executions were public in the United States. I also changed the defendant. I softened the case. I didn't want it to be the rape, murder, stranger thing. And the last thing I wanted was for anybody to start wondering about, is this a mystery, and who did it, and are there fingerprints, and all that stuff. I would have had the Mormon Tabernacle Choir as eyewitnesses to prevent that from happening. So I had a guy kill his wife by in a public place, well, although he didn't quite think it was. It's an outcropping of rock out in the woods. And some people walked out of the woods and saw it happen. So nobody has to worry about did he do it or did he not. You know, it's just that's not an issue. I wanted people to focus on the woman, on her dilemma. If you're interested in focusing on the guy who's about to die, Ernest Gaines wrote a lovely book called A Lesson Before Dying. By all means, read that. We don't need another one. That's not the book I wanted to do. I wanted to study Ellie Robbins, sheriff for all of 3 months, suddenly faced with having to perform this execution. And I think the times in which it happened, that I didn't change. I kept it 1936 because that, I think, was a factor in her decision and what she felt that she had to do. This is her mindset before she ever becomes sheriff. The Robbins lived for the first 10 years of their marriage up on a little mountain farm in a remote part of the hills. I have based the town that they live on Irwin, Tennessee, because he comes down to town originally to get a job in the railroad shops. And in 1936, the jobs in the railroad shops were in Irwin. So picture that, just over the mountain. They had originally lived on that little mountain farm, and all of a sudden they're living in town. And she has to get used to some things that she would never have seen or experienced if she had stayed living up on the mountain, especially during the Depression. So here's LA talking about when they first got there. Those first few months in town, even more than I feared the house shaking to pieces from the passing trains, I worried about the hobos. They were mostly raggedy, unshaven men with gaunt faces and haunted eyes. There were so many men out of work these days, out of money, out of a place to live, and out of any hope for better times. With no homes to go back to, the hobos roamed the country, riding in unlocked boxcars, camping out in hobo jungles near the railroad tracks. Some of them had given up on ever finding another job or a second chance in an ordinary life. They would forage, working a day or two when they could and live off the land. Some of the vagrants were just sad husks turned into failures by an economic disaster they did not understand, and I felt sorry for them. They were like chickens heading for the chopping block but not knowing why. But I was uneasy about them too, because some of them were drunks or dangerously angry, maybe even deranged. Some of those men stole when they got the chance, so you didn't leave a door unlocked or a window open. Somehow the fact that some of these men were well-spoken and obviously educated made it all the more terrible, because those once respectable hobos reminded me that our family might be only one stumble away from sharing the fate of those men, homelessness and hunger. Nothing was safe these days. Every so often, a grimy man in tattered clothes would knock politely, asking for a cup of water or any food that we could spare, offering to do chores in exchange for a meal. If I didn't think the tramp looked menacing, I would usually give him water in a tin cup and a hunk of cornbread if there was any left over from supper. One day I told one of the ragged men, "We don't have much to spare. Why don't you go ask for a handout at the back door of one of those big houses on Elm Street? That's where the rich folks live, the bankers, the lawyers, the railroad bosses. Why, I reckon those folks could give you a whole chicken and never miss it." The fellow shook his head. "Don't you believe it, ma'am. Why, shoot, most of the time the rich folks up on the hill won't give you nothing at all. Poor people will, because they know what it's like to be hungry and cold. They realize how easy it is to get there. It's because they understand that they'll give a man whatever they can spare. But rich people don't think being down and out has anything to do with them, or ever will. They think that being what we are is our own fault, and that maybe we're drunkards or lazy or feeble-minded. They won't give you a thing." Some of the tramps tried to earn a few coins by selling carved boxes fashioned with pocket knives, or they may make wooden toys or whatnots out of a scrap of orange crate or cast off lumber. Some of their handiwork was as good as anything you'd see in a dime store, but I never did buy one. Pretty as they were a reminder of someone who had lost everything, and I didn't want that reminder. So if that's what you had been feeling and seeing for months, and suddenly your husband dies, you have no money, and you feel like there you are right with them, what can you do? Can you really say no to any offer that might save you? So it's Ellie's story. Anybody have any questions?
Sure.
Yes.
We've had a Jackson County had a woman mayor, woman sheriff. When Mr. Griffin Middleton, the sheriff, was shot, his wife took the position.
Yes,
and
it
I
happened.
I remember the year, about 60-something years ago.
Yeah.
We also had a public hanging.
But did she do it?
No. It was earlier than that.
Yeah. And the real woman in Kentucky was getting sacks of mail for weeks before the hanging. Half of them were, "Little lady, I'm going to come down there from Illinois and do that for you." And the other half were marriage proposals. It's very strange.
But
It did happen, and I know of three other women. Corbening, what was her name? Burke County in North Carolina had a woman sheriff, and then two in Texas. So it wasn't unheard of, but most of them weren't called on to do public executions. That was just something that, and it, by 1936, much of the country had gone to something other than hanging, so it wouldn't have been an issue. Electrocutions are not out in public. I should tell you about the last execution in Tennessee and why it was. But anyway, anybody else have any questions?
I just wondered if you have any ideas about what your next book is going to be. You got any new research going or about your next book?
Oh, the next book.
Yes, that's a
good one. I finished the next book. The next book, when you sign a contract with Simon & Schuster, they want a book every 12 months. So even after I turn this one in, I don't have time to wait for them to argue about semicolons and stuff. I have to start immediately on something else. And I've been researching one, and this book, the new one, is coming out in April of 2017. And it was a fascinating case. The story was, I live about 60 miles from Lewisburg, West Virginia, just over the mountain in Virginia. Lewisburg is in Greenbrier County, which is where the Greenbrier Resort is. Yeah, forget that, that's the rich people. I'm talking about the other half of the county. There is a historical marker in Lewisburg that says this is the town in which in which a ghost testified against her murderer. And they said it was the only instance in America. So I decided to look into this. So I went to the Historical Society and said, tell me everything you know about this story. And they gave me a page and a half. It was like one of those little books, you know, Ghost Stories of North Carolina, with a page and a half, and they don't give you dates, and they don't give you names, and so on. And that's all they knew, the Historical Society. So I started looking into it. And what happened was, in 1896, a handsome young blacksmith, who looked kind of like a young Tom Selleck, came to town, and he was very slick and plausible and very vague about his past. And so he started courting a young girl in the community, Zona Heaster, and she was just madly in love with him, and her mother did not like him. He was too slick, too good looking, and a little too vague about his past, and he was over 30, so what had he been doing for the last 12 years? Mama objected, but try telling a 23-year-old she can't marry Tom Selleck. So the wedding went on in November of 1896, and Mama was still mad. Christmas came and went, and the newlyweds did not come for Christmas, and not once did they invite her parents to their house. It was like gone. 6 weeks later, so they're married at the end of November. On the 23rd of January, some riders came up to the Ferentz farm and said, your daughter came over faint in her new house, fell down the stairs, and broke her neck. She's dead. So Mama is very suspicious of this. The groom is cracking jokes. He won't let anybody come near the wife's coffin. He's behaving strangely. Okay, they bury her in the cemetery there where the family goes to church. And a month goes by. And then in February of 1897, the mother goes to the prosecutor in Lewisburg and says, my daughter's ghost appeared to me and said that her husband killed her. And the prosecutor is a dignified lawyer in his 50s, and he really would like her to go away, but she won't. So finally, he gets the three physicians in the county to get together and go exhume the body and do an autopsy. And they found, it was very cold, January, February, so the body was nicely preserved. They found the broken neck and the fingerprints on the skin. So they charged the blacksmith with murder. And that's mildly interesting because of the ghost element, unless you know about the Maria Martin story. And then the question is, how did Mama find out about a case that happened 3,000 miles away? But the one thing that nobody knew was about the lawyers. And when I started looking into that side of it, I realized you don't need the blacksmith and the dead girl. You could put the three lawyers in a booth at Denny's and have a great story. Here are the three attorneys who tried this case. First, the prosecutor. He's 51 years old in 1897, but in 1865, as a teenager, he joined the 14th Virginia Cavalry under McCausland and fought the last 3 months of the war after his older brothers had been killed. Then he went back to Washington and Lee to law school and has spent all of his career in his hometown of Lewisburg practicing law and occasionally being the prosecutor. Okay. The defense attorney was also in the Civil War. He's also in his 50s. He started out as a doctor as a young man, but then he discovered how much fun it was to sue people. So he switched over and became a lawyer. When the Civil War started, Mr. Rucker was a rabid pro-union patriot, I guess. He burned the Cow Pasture Bridge in West Virginia. He burned the New River Bridge in Virginia. And he would ride around with the local Union cavalry under Colonel Crook and tell the Union soldiers, this guy has a sterling silver tea set. You might want to get that. And these guys have horses that are thoroughbreds. And you know, and he really helped them clean out the neighborhood. So you can imagine how popular he was. The weird thing about Mr. Rucker, he owned slaves. Rabid pro-union bridge burner owned slaves. So he didn't see the miniseries. He was not a nice man. 6 weeks before the Emancipation Proclamation goes into effect, he sells his slaves so he won't lose his investment. Oh, he's a real sweetheart. So there he is defending the blacksmith. Now, when you defend somebody in a capital case, you must have two members of counsel, a lead attorney and a second chair. And Mr. Rucker, the bridge burner, had a second chair attorney helping him defend the blacksmith. The second chair attorney was the first African-American lawyer to practice in southern West Virginia. Now, can you imagine those three guys in court? The Confederate cavalry soldier, the crazy bridge burner, and Mr. Gardner, who's 29 years old, caught up in this circus between these two old fellas. So that's who's telling the story. Mama tells the first half when you talk about the daughter getting married and all of her suspicions. And then as soon as it goes into the process of the law, we're hearing the story from young Mr. Gardner. And I didn't change anything. I mean, you cannot make this stuff up. It was fascinating. I found a researcher to help me, and we are this thick in birth certificates, death certificates, census records, business directories, shipping records, everything we could find. I was stalking those guys as if, you know, they were Brad Pitt, so it's probably a good thing they were dead, because I just know everything about them. And when I finish the book, and it's about to come out, I'm going to give copies of my documents to the Greenbrier Historical Society to go along with the page and a half that they knew, because nobody knew anything about these lawyers. Nothing. So, now, it's been really, really a fascinating journey reliving that through all those different points of view. But it's fun. It'll be out in April, and it's called The Unquiet Grave. Thank you for coming. I'll go sign books.